Please be seated. Our third case for this morning is case number 53738, Rasmussen versus Lopez. Mr. Mercado for the appellant, Mr. Flangus, Mr. Vole for the respondents. Ms. Mercado.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. Alice Campos Mercado of Lemons, Grundy and Eisenberg for appellant cross respondent G. Stanmore Rasmussen. And I've asked the clerk to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're here to ask the court to reverse that portion of the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment that found the existence of a third corporate opportunity and also found that Mr. Stan Rasmussen had usurped that opportunity. This court had already determined, and it had been determined for the 15 years preceding the trial, and maybe it was even 17 years by that point, that there were two corporate opportunities. The parties have always known this to be two corporate opportunities. This court's orders indicate there are two corporate opportunities. And in fact, even Judge Adams, when he started the trial, stated that the solitary issue for trial was whether or not Mr. Rasmussen appropriated the opportunity for Carstan for Pegasus and Omni STCs. That's what it has been all along. At the end of the trial, this third opportunity arises based on a pairing of the STCs. The issues that we're raising with regard to that is one of them is it was a violation of Mr. Rasmussen's due process rights. He went in prepared to deal with what he's been dealing with for 15 years before that, which is Omni and Pegasus. And that's what they dealt with all the way through the trial. If you look at the trial statements that were filed by both sides, if you look at the summary judgment motions that were filed by both sides, this case has always been about the Pegasus and the Omni opportunities. That never changed.
How were they referred to in the joint pretrial order, or was there one?
I don't remember there being a joint pretrial order, Your Honor, but even the trial statement of Mr. Lopez did indicate that it was the Pegasus and Omni opportunities, and that's how they broke it out by heading. To get to a third opportunity, we would need substantial evidence to establish that the district court did not commit error, but there wasn't substantial evidence. In fact, Judge Adams indicated that there was very little evidence and a small amount of evidence, and the only way that he got where he got was because he allowed supplemental briefing on the issue.
Now, Mr. Mercado, the order of remand of 2006, the Supreme Court entered to send it back to for Mr. Lopez to try the corporate opportunity claims. After that, was there any breakout or reference to this third corporate opportunity, or was that just created by Judge Adams in the proceedings? Or can you enlighten us on that, how this third opportunity came up?
There wasn't anything after the 2006 remand order. As I indicated, there were summary judgment motions that were filed by both parties before the 2008 trial. No reference to this pairing of STCs to say that there's this third corporate opportunity. They filed trial briefs. Nothing happens throughout the trial until towards the end. It appeared to be maybe some type of epiphany, because on the last day of trial, they start talking about this in pairings. And in fact, at the end of the trial, Judge Adams had indicated that he didn't see that Mr. Rasmussen usurped the Pegasus opportunity or Omni. And he says, well, but I'm going to give you a chance to go ahead and talk about this third pairing of STCs. And he did also say that if those third pairings were part of Pegasus or Omni, that they were not a separate opportunity and there would be no damages to them. And so ultimately, allowing the supplemental briefing is when this third opportunity was developed. So before March 21st of 2008, there was never this third corporate opportunity. And so that's one aspect of it. Even assuming that there was such a thing, this was not a corporate opportunity, and this is where one of the issues arises in this case. This case is governed by Levitt versus Leisure Sports. This court identified what the corporate opportunity is, and the corporate opportunity doctrine, and also stated how difficult it is to determine whether this opportunity actually belongs to the corporation. So we've presented the court with cases from the Delaware courts, because this court has adopted Delaware corporate law in most of its opinions, the most recent one happening in May of this year, where they talked about the impari delicto doctrine. imputing the conduct of a sole shareholder to the corporation. Delaware law, and under Delaware law, if you don't have the ability to develop the opportunity, that business opportunity never comes into fruition as a corporate opportunity. Now, this case is just that. This case also is governed by Levitt because we have a pre-incorporation agreement that the parties have relied on since the inception of this litigation in 1993. When Stan Rasmussen brought the corporate opportunities to, or the business opportunities to Mr. Lopez, he did them in conjunction with paragraph 8 of the pre-incorporation agreement. He spoke of those. He says, I'm presenting them. Here they are. But starting with the Pegasus opportunity in October of 1993, Mr. Lopez would not agree. Now, there has been some discussion in the briefs about, well, you have to have explicit consent or you have to have an outright express rejection, but that's not what Delaware case law holds, and certainly that's not what this court said. In this court, when the court remanded in 2002, it says rejection or abandonment of the opportunity. Now, Delaware case law allows for an implied rejection based on the conduct of the board of directors. That's what happened in this case with regard to the Pegasus opportunity in late October, early November of 1993. The opportunities presented, Mr. Lopez does nothing to try to bring that opportunity into fruition. At the end of it all, as Judge Adams found, Mr. Rasmussen was entitled to that opportunity because the parties could not agree. With that opportunity, with the Pegasus opportunity, Judge Adams says these guys could not develop a toothbrush together. So it's illogical to assume that a few months later, when Mr. Rasmussen is faced with a customer changing the airplanes and he's got to create another STC to conform to the change by the customer, that this now presents this third corporate opportunity that Mr. Rasmussen should be disclosing to Mr. Lopez. Mr. Rasmussen testified, I didn't do that because it was part of Pegasus. And according to the pre-incorporation agreement, once it's mine, I can do whatever I want with it without limitation. He relied on that. And for the reason that Judge Adams didn't really mention it, other than it's a new set of STCs, they're sold to different people, therefore it's a new corporate opportunity. But that's not what the facts bear out.
It was developed for Pegasus, but Pegasus ultimately rejected this third set of STCs, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it grew out of Rasmussen undertaking the Pegasus opportunity that Judge Adams found Karsten had passed on.
Correct. That's exactly right. And
so under Braz, under the Delaware Supreme Court case, could you comment on how that case would fit these facts as a matter of law?
Well, in those cases, that case specifically, the court talks about the corporate director being presented with an opportunity where the corporation has pretty much divested itself of that opportunity through the conduct that it has created. In that case, the conduct at issue is that the corporation is getting away from these cellular licenses. And so in this case, I think it's analogous because Mr. Rasmussen is aware that Karsten cannot develop this corporation or this opportunity because its funds are frozen, because Mr. Lopez has in his mind that he can develop it. He's not giving any indication that he's willing to concede at all that maybe he should be contributing some amount to the development, and it's all because he's basically colluding with one of the GSR employees to determine that he wants to be the one. In fact, he testifies that he had planned on taking the Pegasus opportunity. So his intransigence, all of his conduct displayed that he was not going to let Karsten accept this opportunity because then he would have to share it with Rasmussen. His goal was, I want to get it for me and Mr. Kernkamp to develop our own company, and we're going to develop it. So to say that a few months later, the corporation had it presented again to deal with the same thing, it makes absolutely no sense. And that's the Kaplan case that we also cite in our briefs. In Kaplan, the court said, if you've presented basically a similar opportunity and the corporation has already rejected it, you don't have to wait to get a formal explicit consent or a formal explicit rejection. the corporate officer is entitled to rely on the previous rejection, and that's what happens in this case.
Did this alleged third opportunity arise after Rasmussen had invoked the put where he wanted to either buy or sell his interest in the corporation?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. He invoked that, the buyout provision, in August of 1993. The second, or this alleged third opportunity, the second Pegasus STCs, happened in January, the early part of 1994. One other issue that I want to address before I move on is this issue that there has to be an automatic corporate opportunity violation or usurpation because there's been an appropriation of assets. And it's important because in this case, Judge Steinheimer had already ruled on the issue of whether or not the engineering data that they're claiming to be this misappropriation of assets, she had already determined that they didn't belong to Carson, and therefore that issue should be dead in the water as of now. The assertion that Rasmussen use all of these assets and therefore he's precluded or stopped from declaring that these are his corporate opportunities. Again, it's if you even assume that Judge Steinheimer didn't already rule on that issue, that factor is only a factor. It's not a complete estoppel. And the final thing on that point is there's no indication that Rasmussen used anything that belonged to Carson. He used GSR's computer data. He used GSR's engineering data. And so with that, Your Honor, I will, unless the court has any questions, I'll wait and reserve the rest of my time.
You have about 3 minutes and 42 seconds left. Ms. Flangus, on behalf of the respondent.
Good morning. In addressing this case, I want to first point out that I have the easy part. I get to stand here and do the oral argument. The briefing in this matter by Mr. Vohl, frankly, was a treatise on corporate opportunity doctrine. A lot of what we were covering is in the brief. But I do want to focus on two things. The fact is that we have a cross appeal that I'm firmly convinced is dispositive of the issues on the main appeal. Vast majority of them except for the cost issue. So I'm going to spend most of my time addressing the issues raised on the cost appeal. And the issues raised on the cross appeal deal with under what circumstances the corporate opportunity doctrine should be available to prohibit a clearly non-interested fiduciary in usurping the opportunity. The last remand from this court was not a remand to consider a dispute between two directors. It was not a dispute to determine contractual arguments. It was a dispute that this court sent back to find out what were Carstan's rights as a corporation with a clearly non-interested fiduciary, and what did that fiduciary have to do to exercise the opportunity. The primary mistake made by the district court was in getting sidetracked in perceiving this remanded action as one involving a dispute between two disinterested corporate directors and deciding on the relative reasonableness as between the two of them, their conduct. This was not remanded for a determination of relative reasonableness. It was remanded, and what this case was about on remand was when there is an interested director, Rasmussen, who has his own company, third party, involved, what are the issues that allow Rasmussen to undertake a corporate opportunity when faced with the fact that the issues involve his own separate company and bills that he maintains or owed? There are four reasons, specific reasons, why the corporate opportunity doctrine prohibited Rasmussen from taking the opportunity in this case. Number one, there was no clear rejection by the corporation. In fact, Judge Adams found, and the evidence is clear, there was an acceptance by Carstan of the opportunities for Pegasus, for Omni, and for the third pair. The problem was Karstan simply questioned the bill that GSR had and the estimates that GSR had for going forward to do the engineering. The fact that Karstan had a reasonable belief that the bill that it was being claimed to owe was excessive, and we know it was a reasonable belief because over $40,000 of that bill was not awarded to GSR at the conclusion of the case. So Karstan had a reasonable belief that it could dispute the bill and yet still accept the opportunity. Judge Adams looked at this and said, well, was Lopez reasonable in disputing the bill? Was Lopez reasonable in the things that he did as Lopez, rather than say, was Karstan reasonable in disputing the bill? Clearly, Karstan was. Was Lopez reasonable acting as the only disinterested director in questioning the amount of money that the Pegasus STCs would cost to develop? Well, clearly he was. He was relying on independent information provided to him by one of Rasmus's employees that the cost should only be about $25,000, not the $150,000 Mr. Rasmussen said. And consequently, the situation Rasmussen finds himself in is, what are my duties to the corporation? I said there were four things. One, rejection. There was no rejection. Number two, there had to be full disclosure by Mr. Rasmussen of all the circumstances necessary for Karstan to make the decision. Full disclosure included the disclosure that I, as a fiduciary, may go into competition with my corporation. I have that obligation. We've cited numerous authorities that state that that disclosure requirement, Regal Beloit, the Owen Hamilton case, Clicky, they all say you have to make a full disclosure because it is a necessary determination of the corporation. Whether you really intend to go down that road might be something the corporation would use. As an independent director, Mr. Lopez would have needed to know, you're going to pursue this Pegasus opportunity. I guess maybe I'd better just acquiesce and go along with the number. But the other thing he could say is, well, how much do you think we could make on it? How much do you think there's going to be an interest in this? All of those facts are important. Mr. Rasmussen disclosed none of them. So there has to be a disclosure before you can, there has to be a rejection before you can take the opportunity. There was no clear rejection. There has to be a full disclosure. There was no full disclosure. There has to be a lack of a conflict of interest. And this is a fundamental principle that as lawyers we understand. If a client comes to me and wants me to take a case and I have another client, I cannot take steps to figure out a way to take the case. I have a conflict, I cannot take it. In this circumstance, Mr. Rasmussen, as the president of GSR, the third company out here, had the ability to control whether they would negotiate on their bill or whether they would deal with Karstan. Mr. Rasmussen would have you believe that by virtue of his decision that I'm not going to deal with Karstan, therefore I have an inability. And because we have an inability, I'm free to take the corporate opportunity, turns the entire doctrine on its head. As the cases we cited talk about, you are in a tough spot when you are the fiduciary director who also owns the third party that the corporation has to negotiate with. You cannot utilize your position to make it difficult. And more importantly, the court says we don't want to have to analyze these things after the fact. We don't want to look at them on a case-by-case basis. The case law says this needs to be a hard and fast line. If you are an interested director and you have control over the problem, you don't get to take the opportunity. We were not saying that Mr. Rasmussen had to pay the money out of his own pocket. We're simply saying if they couldn't come to a resolution with Karstan, then the opportunity simply is lost. Case law is out there that says even when the opportunity is lost, that conflict of interest cannot come into play. There's no way for Rasmussen to get around that. It is clearly dispositive of the issue on all three STCs. The last point, I said there were four. There was
if
no
that were so, then why would there have been a remand? If it's a question of law, why would there have been a remand for trial on the issue of usurpation of corporate opportunity by this court in Appeals 1 and 2?
Well, actually, probably a pretty good question, Your Honor. The remand was specific because the focus of the prior district court rulings had been as between Lopez and Rasmussen, and it was unclear to this court whether there had been findings made, I believe, by the district court related to usurpation, related to, are these things an issue? Could these things be that, yes, there was no rejection? Well, those are factual issues. The court did ultimately determine there was no rejection. Was there disclosure? Those are factual issues. The district court made a determination of the disclosures that were there. There were no disclosures about Rasmussen making his desire to pursue the opportunity known
but
that he intended.
But within 6 days of his first disclosure of this opportunity, he was litigating under the clause of the pre-incorporation agreement that allowed him to force a buy-sell.
The problem, Your Honor, is that on the remand, the pre-incorporation agreement is no longer specifically at issue in the case. The decisions...
I understand that, but I'm a little... You're saying that there was no disclosure that he intended to go his own way.
Correct.
I have trouble accepting that that's not an issue of fact under the record. Plus, given the fact that within 6 days of him making this disclosure, he's in litigation over whether Carstan should be dissolved, as I understand it. Maybe I'm wrong on the record.
No, actually, it's 4 days, Your Honor, even less time. They have a conference call on October 29th, and Mr. Rasmussen says, we have this opportunity. Now, the buyout has been sitting out there for a couple of months. Mr. Lopez is saying, I need information from you, Rasmussen, to know how to formulate a number under the buyout. 4 days later, after the phone call where you first find out, as Mr. Lopez, the only uninterested director, that there's an opportunity. 4 days later, there's a lawsuit filed to dissolve the corporation. What it doesn't tell you, though, what the disclosure doesn't say is that I'm going to pursue this right away, that this is how much it costs, this is what it's going to be, and these are the opportunities. There's millions of dollars sitting out there. None of those things were disclosed by Mr. Rasmussen. In fact, as Mr. Vole points out in the brief, by filing a lawsuit asking for a judicial determination, it's along the lines of, well, I'd like to get this relief. Am I entitled to it? It's like an insurance company that says, well, we want to file a deck relief to find out if we have to pay the bill, but we've got the money and we'll tender it. That's not what Mr. Rasmussen did. He filed the lawsuit and said, yes, I'll find out. But then 4 days later, I should say within a matter of a short period of time after filing the lawsuit, he simply ran off with the opportunity. He didn't wait for the court to come in and say yes. Mr. Lopez is sitting back saying, well, at the conclusion of this case, I guess we'll find out what to do. But in the meantime, I'll wait and hear if this opportunity is going to be forthcoming. Never found out until all of a sudden it was done.
I'm going to switch gears here, but I would like to hear your thoughts on Ms. Mercado's argument on the cross-appeal with respect to this so-called third opportunity. Was that litigated in the first trial under the banner of breach of fiduciary duty, or did that only make its appearance at the end of the trial before Judge Adams in trial number three, or proceeding number three?
All of the STCs have been at issue in the cases because of the profit figures and because of the numbers involved, Your Honor. The numbers didn't change. It's not my understanding is the numbers, and keep in mind, in order to determine the profits, and the profits that Carstan was always contending it was entitled to, were all the profits, $5,200,000 plus. There was specific facts in front of Judge Adams, not on post-trial issues, specific facts on the amount of the profit made for those third STCs. That information was obtained previously. That was not newly developed information. The reason that Pegasus causes a concern is this. Pegasus was the customer that contacted for the first pair. Pegasus was the customer that contacted for the third pair, but notably was not the customer that ultimately paid for the third pair. The customers that paid for the third pair were new customers with new money, new opportunities, new issues. There is no, by the way, no case I think this court can find where the corporate opportunity doctrine says, well, if you turn down one opportunity, the world is open to you for all the others. That portion of Judge Adams's decision is really easy to uphold. There was clearly no disclosure at all of the third opportunity.
When did that issue enter the case, not from the standpoint of the numbers, but from the standpoint of treating that legally as a separate corporate opportunity?
I can't say it wasn't litigated in the first case, Your Honor, but I cannot point you to the first case specifically. I know it was litigated in the third case. I cannot say to you in this portion of the record it was litigated in the first case, although the profits certainly were.
How was it brought up, Mr. Flanagan? Because that's what we're trying, a little confused on going through the record. Was it brought up by you, Judge Adams? Who developed this whole third opportunity issue?
Well, it was certainly brought up by Karstan in addressing the fact that these STCs were part and parcel of what should be paid, that it was the patient of corporate opportunities and that there were three opportunities. That was really not a question mark. The question mark was, did Rasmussen do a good job of demonstrating how much he paid, how much money went into the development of the third pair? That was the significant portion of the facts that were not established. And frankly, as we pointed out in the record, there are no facts regarding what was specifically paid. There was a number that was stipulated to and actually ran through in the first case. There was a number that established the total amount for the STCs. That total amount of $670,000 included the third pair development costs. So clearly there were numbers that had to be litigated in the first case.
What about the offset, the judge at? What was it, $150,000?
$150,000, if you look at the record, the $150,000, frankly, the judge estimated and guessed. He even said so. He said, I'm troubled. I can't just pull a number out of thin air, but I'm going to pull out $150,000. Because what happened was there was no evidence of specific numbers, and what the judge said was, I'm going to pull this number out because, you know, it's a little higher than your theory, which is we proposed a theory that said revenues to overall costs, and the revenues from the third pair were smaller, so the overall cost would be about $75,000. That was at least one way to do it. I said there were 4 points. I'd like to make the fourth point. I'm using up part of my rebuttal time. I apologize. But the fourth point really is that Karstan's assets were utilized, and case law is out there that says, look, I don't care if it's $15,000 worth, which was the feasibility study. I don't care if it's the $167,000 that they paid for the Omni. Ultimately, GSR recovered a judgment and got paid for work that it did for Karstan. Mr. Rasmussen clearly used the work done by Karstan to develop the Pegasus STCs, the third pair STCs, and the Omni STCs. He even says to Omni, this will be easy. It will only take a little bit of time. His letter back to Omni didn't tell Carlos Lopez, I'm going to take this for me. I'm going to do it. And by the way, I'm going to use everything we've already developed. And the corporate opportunity doctrine says unequivocally, you simply can't do that. For 4 reasons, then, I would submit to this court, no rejection, insufficient disclosure, conflict of interest, and frankly, use of Karstan's assets. And yes, they probably did exist last time we were here, but they are clearly here this time. Thank you.
Mr. Mercado and rebuttal. I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes, and then I'm going to give you, Mr. Flanagan, 2 minutes for your cross-appeal. So you'll have 5 minutes and 42 seconds, and you'll have 2 minutes for your cross-appeal rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I'd like to address those same 4 points, although I kind of addressed them a little bit when I did my presentation. On the no clear rejection point, I think the Delaware law case law is pretty clear that you don't need this clear rejection in terms of an express. It can be implicit. In the Brudney and Clark article that we cited to the court, it indicates that the conduct of the corporate director can also be imputed to the corporation, and therefore it can show that there has been an implied rejection. With regard to the full disclosure that Mr. Rasmussen didn't disclose that he may compete with the corporation, well, that's the pre-incorporation agreement, and that's why this case is controlled by Levitt. In the pre-incorporation agreement, it fully contemplates that one of those directors is going to compete with Karstan because it contemplates that I'm presenting this opportunity. If you're not going to take it, I can take it without limitation. So they have a built-in conflict, but they have agreed to that conflict, which is why Levitt controls. Is that very same situation that existed in Levitt where there's an agreement to say, well, we're going to proceed with this opportunity that's separate and it's our company, and the court says, they agreed to that. Small companies, it allows that flexibility, and that's what's going on here. And that same issue with regard to the lack of conflict of interest. Well, that conflict of interest, again, is built in into this situation. One of the things that counsel said is that Mr. Rasmussen filed this lawsuit, said he never said he was going to proceed with this opportunity. Now, trial exhibit number 31 is a letter from Mr. Rasmussen's attorney to Mr. Lopez's attorney, and he says, and this is at page 2408 of the joint appendix, volume 13, under the terms of paragraph 8 of the pre-incorporation agreement, Stan, and only Stan, is now able to independently do STC for Pegasus. So the lawsuit was not brought about so that they can try to figure out who can take it. Mr. Rasmussen knew he could take it because he had the pre-incorporation agreement. One of the reasons for the lawsuit was not only to dissolve CARSAN, that process had started with the invocation of the buyout agreement, but also because at that point, Mr. Lopez, through his attorney and personally, is saying, I'm going to take the Pegasus opportunity. I've got Kern Camp, I've got GSR's computer stuff, and he called Dallas from Pegasus to talk to him about the opportunity. That's all in the record. So to say that the lawsuit was filed and that the implication was that they were going to wait until it was over, if that were the case, they'd still be waiting in Pegasus. I don't even know if they're still in business. Because here we are, 17, 18 years later, and the lawsuit's still not over. So the lawsuit by itself does not say that, you know, it's implied. In fact, that's one of the issues that they raised to Judge Adams, and he says, how you doing? Here we are still. It was 2008. So the lawsuit is not a factor. The CARSAN's assets were utilized. Again, Judge Steinheimer talked about that very issue when they brought a motion to her on the trade secrets issue. The jury had decided that Mr. Rasmussen did not appropriate trade secrets that belonged to CARSAN. One of the things that Judge Steinheimer said in her order was that CARSAN was not in the business of engineering. The engineering data belonged to GSR. The fact that Rasmussen had it didn't make it CARSAN's. The fact that he developed that engineering data for a CARSAN SDC didn't mean that it was CARSAN's engineering data. That data belonged to GSR. And the cases also provide that you look at the usurpation issue at the time the opportunity is presented. At the time that this opportunity was presented, Lopez hadn't paid for that. CARSAN hadn't paid for any of that information either. So at the same time, it's not CARSAN's data. But again, just based on Judge Steinheimer's order, and that is at page 138 of the record of volume 1, is where her order begins. But at page 51, she says that the jury specifically found that Rasmussen did not misappropriate any trade secrets or computer programs belonging to CARSAN. That issue has not been appealed. That's a final issue. So it's not something that they can raise again. Taking it one step further to, did they use the information? One of the things that is said in the briefs is that Mr. Rasmussen used the data from an earlier STC to develop the Pegasus STC, and that is incorrect. There was a feasibility study, and then Mr. Rasmussen did testify as to what he used or when he actually applied for the Pegasus opportunity. He applied for it in December of 1993. There has been an issue that, well, no, we're relying on an affidavit that the court didn't allow him to use. But in fact, Mr. Rasmussen testified at trial, and this is at volume 9 of the appendix at pages 1726 through 29, that he applied for those STCs in December of 1993. So he didn't go back and use an STC application that had been made previously. Again, it's a matter of, and he testified quite clearly, that he can proceed on. I would just submit to the court in the no time that I have left that there is not substantial evidence to support the district court's finding of a third opportunity, and the substantial evidence does support the existence that Mr. Rasmussen owned the Pegasus and Omni opportunities. Thank you.
Mr. Flangus, 2 minutes and your rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to focus on a couple of things. Looking at Omni, if you remember, there were three pairs. There was the first pair. The dispute was over how much Mr. Rasmussen said needed to be paid in order to go forward. Omni, the dispute was an existing debt. In the Omni case, the opportunity was presented with a condition, a string attached. And the condition was, pay the full amount that GSR demands. If you don't pay the full amount that GSR demands, you don't get the Omni opportunity. Problem with that is the jury ultimately determined how much Carson had to pay, and Carson had to pay $175,000, not the $212,000 that was demanded. What did Carson pay for? They paid for the engineering. It was their engineering that was utilized to make Omni. It's very clear, very clear. The other thing with regard to Omni is there was no disclosure. If this court will remember, the Omni opportunity was presented, and Lopez's attorney wrote back and says, we're considering it. And while they were considering it, Omni was usurped by Mr. Rasmussen. Lopez came back and said, this is a good idea, let's go forward with Omni, and it was already gone. Now, as a matter of law, this court could find that you could set the policy that says you have to at least allow a reasonable time for response before you can determine any rejection. Keep in mind here, the district court found an implied rejection at best. No overt objection, and as stated in, I'm going to quote Amger, because the language was categorical response. No categorical response whatsoever. So I'd like to leave the court with this last thought. What is the policy that this court wants established in Nevada with regard to the corporate opportunity doctrine? When you have an interested director who controls a third party, and that third party is making demands to be paid on a bill, and ultimately demands that a jury determines are excessive, what kind of policy does this court want to establish? A strong, clear policy where we know when you can take the opportunity and when you can't? Or a policy that says, well, we'll do it on a case-by-case basis and let everyone decide whether the reasonableness of the individuals is at issue? That's too difficult a bright-line test. That's why no jurisdiction has adopted that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to, well, this case will stand submitted. The panel thanks both counsel for your informative discussion of the corporate opportunity. Thank you. We'll be in recess till 1:30.